On today's Up Record, is there a difference between propaganda and marketing?
Up Record is a podcast focused on the marketing and advertising industry from the perspective of two industry experts. Hosts Matt Farrar and Joe Clements are co-founders of Strategic Digital Services, a digital marketing firm based in Tallahassee, Florida, and founded in 2014. I'm Matt Farrar.
I'm Joe Clements.
And I'm Rebecca Romero.
And this is the Podcast of Record.
Hey, everybody. It's been a couple of weeks. We've had a lot of teams on the road here at the office, so we haven't been able to record. Producer Alex has been in Alaska. Yep. Welcome back, Producer Alex, from the last great frontier. Yeah, thank you. You're very close to Russia. How did that feel?
Alarmingly.
Alarmingly close to Russia.
Yep. Just always in the back of my head.
Yeah. I wanted to go over, I think what's happening now, Russia and Ukraine, there's a lot of parts to it. A big part of it is what's going on in the internet and the messaging battle that's happening. So I wanted to spend a few minutes to cover some thoughts on that.
Okay.
So if you've been paying attention to what's going on, you are the subject of what I think is the first real full-scale global propaganda campaign, at least in the West, since World War II. And it's the first to take place since the advent of the internet, since social media. And so there's things going on that I think are just below our level of awareness that are important to consider because they're brand new factors in human existence and civilization, in the conduct of nations and superpower conflict, which is inherently what we're in. It's also not clear to me that most analysts on this subject have fully understood or considered what's going on with the internet and how the internet is driving it. So let's start with the question, is there a difference between propaganda and marketing, or propaganda and advertising, or propaganda and public relations? And when I lecture at Florida State on this, I always make the argument that no, there is not. And in fact, the godfather of public relations, a man named Edward Bernays, who is Sigmund Freud's nephew, interestingly enough, also argued that there is no difference, but that propaganda coming out of World War I had such a negative sentiment around the idea that he just relabeled it public relations. So took all of the learning from it and turned it into public relations and what is modern marketing, branding, advertising. He actually wrote several books on the subject, which are pretty seminal in communications philosophy. And I'm going to read a quote from one of his books called Propaganda. And here it is. The consciousness and intelligent manipulation of the organized habits and opinions of the masses is an important element in democratic society. Those who manipulate this unseen mechanism of society constitute an invisible government, which is the true ruling power of our country. We have governed, our minds are molded, our tastes formed, and our ideas suggested largely by men we have never heard of. It is they who pull the wires that control the public mind. So his assertion is that they're one and the same, and that they are so vast in scale that most people don't even notice that it's working. So when you think of propaganda, and what's interesting is Bernays was Jewish, but Joseph Goebbels, the Nazi propagandist, was a huge admirer of him and actually tried to hire him in the 30s. And Bernays was not up for that, even though Bernays is responsible for the, you know, widest spread use of tobacco and cigarettes in the country. Also, that was one of his big claim to fame, was especially smoking among women. Interesting guy if you Google and look at what he wrote and what he was up to. You think the propaganda posters of World War II, you think Rosie the Riveter, you might think the Nazi depiction of kind of deformed, monstrous looking Jewish people as propaganda. Propaganda's come a long ways since the poster, and we know intuitively it's happening on the internet. And so let's go over a few of the things that I think are notable. So one is, at the beginning of this conflict, you would have absolutely expected, given how much credit, and I think unduly, Russia gets for interfering in American elections, that Russia just would have steamrolled the messaging of the war. They have not. In fact, I would argue they have been absolutely cut out of the messaging. Specifically, and this Bernays points this out, is Russia doesn't actually control any of the platforms of those messaging. They don't control Facebook. They don't really control American media. They don't control Twitter. And so when they were cut out early on of messaging directly on those platforms, they had no way to message into the West. So all the leverage went to Ukraine on that. And Ukraine, which is a country that's kind of notorious for its own like bot and hacker farms, they're no minor league team in terms of engagement and propaganda and cyber, have done an incredibly good job at winning over the mind of the United States and the West, and at a speed that I don't think anyone was prepared for. Yeah. Even if you don't like Putin and Russia. So let's think through this. Some of this propaganda successes. Ghost of Kiev is the first one that comes to mind, which the Defense Ministry of Ukraine put out a video from a video game, which they said was the Ghost of Kiev, which had shot down 6 Russian fighters in dogfights in like 2 days. And to give you context, to be a, quote, ace fighter pilot, you have to have 3 kills. That's what it takes to be an ace. And so this, Michael Jordan of dogfighting, allegedly shot down 6. And that turns out to be untrue. But it didn't matter that it was untrue because it spread so quickly on the internet in the media that by the time the debunking happened, the psychological implications for both Russians that found out about it, people in the West and Ukrainians themselves, had already changed dramatically. Like, oh, we're crushing the Russians in the air. Zelensky himself is good, right? He gets offered an evacuation. What does he say? I don't need a ride. I need ammunition.
Yeah.
Great line. Gets replicated and repeated over the internet. Becomes a meme. I don't need a ride. I need ammunition. You see consistent images of, burned out Russian armor, Russian helicopters being shot down. Now, the fact is, who knows what's actually going on over there? My guess is our government has satellites that are watching in near real time and has a pretty good idea of what's going on. I don't think most journalists do. I think there's probably some more correspondents on Twitter and Substack and podcasts that may have an idea. But we don't know. So we're just exposed to a flood of videos about Russian tanks, helicopters being blown up, Russian troops surrendering en masse. Pretty classic battlefront type propaganda designed to disorient the enemy, to create fear in the enemy, to get the enemy to give up. If the message to the Russian soldiers, hey, everybody else is giving up, you should give up too. You don't want to be the last to give up. That can be demoralizing for those forces and also encourage your own people. You see a ton of stories about Ukrainians coming back to Ukraine to fight. You see Ukrainian beauty queens posting pictures of themselves and battle rattle holding rifles, which turn out to be airsoft rifles, right? There's pictures of people holding essentially wooden AK-47s to look like an AK-47 in a picture, but there's not a real arm. All this is to say, this flood of information about what's going on in Ukraine has dramatically shaped how everybody in the West feels about the conflict. Regardless of facts on the ground, regardless of causes, it is pretty much instantly submitted an opinion that Russians are Putin's dictatorial aggressor, the Russian army is incompetent, and the Ukrainians are freedom fighters who we should all get behind. Zelensky's the George Washington of Ukraine. Now, I'm not making a comment on anything regarding the facts of the situation. I'm not an expert on Russia. I am an expert on the internet and communications over the internet. My guess is the difference between what is popularly believed in the West and in the United States is pretty substantially different from what's going on the ground. It is an all conflict. But this is an example of how rapidly this sort of messaging moved and changed public opinion. So let's dive into that a little further. What has been the result? And what is the thing that I think is very dangerous that I don't think was in anybody's wargaming or battle plans? And it's this. If you give me a moment, I'm actually going to pull up a list here of the companies that have, without being required for sanction purposes, have exited Russia and did so within days or weeks of the conflict breaking out. Not because they're legally required to do by the country they're headquartered in, but because of essentially what I think the best analogy is we are witnessing the cancellation of a nuclear armed superpower. The same way a celebrity might get canceled or a political personality might get canceled, where their endorsement deals drop and their neighbors hate them, we're seeing the incidental, an unplanned for phenomena of unplugging a nuclear armed superpower from the modern world. Mm-hmm. So this is Adidas not selling tracksuits. This is Audi not selling cars. This is the BBC not carrying any Russian company ads. This is FIFA not allowing competition. This is Facebook going down in Russia. This is Google and Snapchat going down in Russia. This is Visa and MasterCard and Amex pulling out of Russia. This is the SWIFT system, which are the rails that the finance system runs on, being disconnected from Russia. This is Oracle leaving Russia. These are the major consulting firms leaving Russia. This is a non-trivial thing that's happening. So I want, if you're listening, imagine your life if you woke up tomorrow and you could no longer check your Gmail or send Gmails through your Gmail. You could no longer make payments on your credit or debit card in your country or otherwise. So you had to have cash to transact. Imagine your streaming services. So Netflix goes down, your entertainment is gone. So imagine that impact not only in your personal life, on your business, on your job. Suddenly you can see this cascading problem that I don't think anybody intended or understood, right? And the problem has been so powerful that Switzerland, which never takes sides, is taking sides on this, but unexpectedly and quickly and without warning. And so this cascade, this network activation, if you will, this epiphenomena that's happening on the internet, but is incepting ideas and thoughts and concepts into the minds, not just of average people, but of CEOs and CMOs and CFOs around the world, is producing a very dangerous scenario where the governments who are involved in these conflicts and the governments who can take thoughtful approaches to leveraging sanctions, and then they can also withdraw sanctions as leverage, are losing control of that economic sanctioning value. So, you know, what Biden says or what the EU or what NATO says or sanctions may not matter anymore. Because if those companies still have the pressure generated from the propaganda efforts and the network-based consensus that Russia needs to be disconnected and punished in some way, it actually doesn't matter if nations withdraw the sanction, because the nation state is not the thing that's in control of those economic stations. Biden didn't require Apple to pull out. He didn't require Apple to pull out. They pulled out on their own. And so it's not clear if when those sanctions are over, when the Biden administration wants to end them as leverage in a deal, or Europe wants to end them as leverage in a deal, if they can actually bring back or reinstate those services in Russia. Mm-hmm. So there's this problem that no one's really in control of this hive mind that's now activated in the cancellation of a nuclear armed superpower. So let's take this one step further to why this matters for the internet. There's some debate I've seen about how much this matters or how true it is. There's an article in Fortune from yesterday. So on March 11th, Russia, whether you believe it's a total disconnection from the internet or a partial disconnection from the internet, is basically going internal on its internet, on its DNS. It's setting up its own DNS servers. It's telling every government-backed site, government-controlled site, which in Russia could literally be all of them or 70% of them, to scrub JavaScript from their pages, risk of hacking, and to only be listed in Russia and only host data in Russia. Now, there's two ways you look at that. One is that's a defensive maneuver. That's like, all right, well, we're going to prepare for inbound cyber attacks. And the only way to protect ourselves is if we have this digital iron curtain around the country. This is very similar to the Great Chinese Firewall. Actually, probably a little stronger in some ways where Russia will end up. So this is the first time outside of China we've seen a segmentation of the internet. So we're literally in this process of watching this global internet fragment into something that isn't that is isolated. And so do we have a Russian internet, a Chinese internet, a Western internet, you know, wherever else an internet pops up, which means that one of the powers of the internet has been to connect globally. There seems to be a disconnection going on. So in the same way these companies are disconnecting from Russia and disconnecting Russia, Russia is building its own internet, its own internal network, which is a totally different way of operation in terms of the internet. Actually, one of the notable things is Ukraine has asked for the nonprofit that manages the DNS system. The DNS system is like the address system for the internet. When you buy a domain, you're essentially registering it with the DNS to like, hey, unlist Russian URLs. And that group said, no, we're not going to do that, which is good. Similar how Elon Musk is actually getting pressure to turn off everybody's Teslas in Russia, which, man, you want to talk about something that would set smart cars or electric cars back. When people realize that somebody can just turn off your car remotely, that's a problem for that market. So the reason this matters is you have this fragmentation of the open internet that's existed for our entire lifetimes coming into play. But two, and maybe more concerning, is everybody seems to look at Ukraine as there's a war on the ground in Ukraine, you know, something that appears to be between an Iraq and a Syria, what, you know, what's going on or what will be happening. And, you know, of course, in Iraq, we're kind of on the other side. In Iraq, we were for the superpower and against the guerrillas. And in Ukraine, we're going to be against the superpower and for the guerrillas. That's kind of the nature of politics in general. But we're on the flip side of that now. We're on the flip side of what we'll think is acceptable and okay to do. So when Russia is fully disconnected, if they can make that happen, and it's maybe they can't, being internalized like that is going to set the stage for the escalation between war on the ground. So there are levels between war on the ground and like nuclear. And I don't think we recognize how devastating the levels between war on the ground and nuclear actually are. You can make a case that the deployment of tactical nuclear weapons may actually be better and safer for everybody than the deployment of what could be coming in terms of cyber space. So if Russia can isolate, then they can launch their counter cyber attacks. And so what does a counter cyber attack look like? Well, it probably looks something to the extent of like what Russians are experiencing. So imagine if next week our company couldn't buy ads on Facebook anymore because Facebook's payment processing system got taken offline. And that's a small one. Imagine if your bank online account login just got reset and you could not reset your password to get in to your bank. Imagine if your bank's records of like your financial transactions just got wiped out, or one bank. And, you know, that's financial. You could take that a step further and maybe it's infrastructure. Maybe it's a power plant that gets knocked offline. Maybe it's a bridge that gets knocked offline. Like, you know, what are the bridges called that raise up and down?
Drawbridge.
Drawbridge. Are they called drawbridges still? That seems medieval. I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah. But what if those get hacked so they're just locked in the open position and nobody can cross, you know, rivers for days at a time in a city? What if they take a subway down so there's infrastructure attacks that can come? And what's interesting about some cyber attacks is we're used to these ransomware attacks where the hacker gets in and like, haha, I'll sell you back your database if you send me $100,000. Those are happening all the time everywhere now. And so we tend to think of cyber as being something reversible, that data is saved somewhere and we can restore it from a server. In cyber attacks against infrastructure, the way those attacks take place sometimes, they actually result in damage to the physical infrastructure, to the electric transformer, to the motor. And so it may not be as simple as just being able to pay a ransom or come to a negotiated agreement where, like, they make the motor work again or make the transformer work again. It may actually destroy equipment that takes weeks or months to replace. And in a strained supply chain world that we're already in, where this is affecting manufacturing labs across the country, what if it takes a year to get the new transformer built and delivered? What if it takes 8 months to get the new motor to raise the bridge built and installed? So what's setting up to happen is not trivial. That doesn't even include space. Like, what happens if you knock out communication satellites? What happens if you knock out weather satellites? There's things that are very vulnerable that we're used to having access to that are pretty easy just to take down and that we haven't seen before in the modern world. We haven't seen a full-scale cyber war. We haven't seen a full-scale space infrastructure war. And space infrastructure is also not trivial to replace. How long does it take to build and launch and get a satellite positioned in orbit? The answer to that is years. If you knock out certain weather satellites, if you knock out communication satellites, that doesn't come back for a long time in some cases.
So it's not really ransomware at this point. It's like a digital nuke.
Yeah, it's a digital nuke. And so I think we are still, even though we understand we are totally dependent on the internet, we still see it as this thing that's ethereal and can just be reset and rebuilt in the push of a button. When the reality is it's so tied into physical life that an attack on digital infrastructure ends up being as damaging as a physical attack on that infrastructure, a physical attack on those systems. And so keeping that in mind, there's this escalation we're probably not prepared for or thinking of, between ground war in Ukraine and the use of, like, you know, some sort of nuclear Armageddon that can make life really hard for everybody and hasn't been possible since the internet. Now, let me loop this back around to the difference between propaganda and marketing, and that I don't believe there is one. In conflict and war, there's actually two types of propaganda that are run. There's home front propaganda and there's battlefront propaganda. Battlefront propaganda, you're using to encourage your people and demoralize the enemy. Homefront propaganda, which is what most of us here in the United States are experiencing one way or another, is completely driven by giving everybody the buy-in it takes to make the sacrifice to leverage the war. So if I had told you a year ago, hey, you're going to be totally okay paying $6 a gallon for gas. In fact, it's going to be considered unpatriotic and, like, pro-communist if you are not okay paying $6 a gallon for gas. You would have said that is crazy. Mm-hmm. But that is the impact of the messaging on the American mind right now, is that $5 a gallon of gas or $6 a gallon of gas, $8 a gallon of gas is good. And so the propaganda, the messaging, essentially, right now, the way this conflict's playing out is we're not being conscripted into a draft, but we're being economically conscripted into a conflict. Mm-hmm. And most people, I don't think, are aware that that's happening because it's happening slowly. And it's going to be in wheat prices, which impacts food and meat prices and grocery and everything else is going to go up. And so this is also one of the first conflicts at a global scale that's being waged in a substantial economic dimension, which we're experiencing. And this is all enabled, by the way, to happen very quickly at a speed no one thought possible because of the ability of the internet to trigger empathetic response and incept ideas in large populations of people very quickly. So those are the thoughts on how I have on how Russia-Ukraine is impacting the internet, the future of the internet, the relationship between marketing and propaganda. You know, there probably is no difference. It's just the use case. And there's the main purpose I have for this episode, and we'll try and do another normal episode this week, is in thinking through how critical and important the internet is for the modern age, both good and bad. It enables a lot of our modern lifestyle, but it also makes every country incredibly vulnerable to losing that nearly overnight, as you see in Russia, and as we might face here at some point if a cyber war escalates, or space. So it can be taken away almost instantly. But then also the power of the messages that come across, that we are almost unaware of how impactful they are in getting us to buy into things that we would not have imagined we would buy in on even a short time ago, a year, 3 months, 6 months. So that's all. If you like the podcast, please leave a review. If you like the cheerier podcast, we're going to try and do another one this week on some marketing news. And there is plenty of marketing news actually going on to talk about. Otherwise, if you enjoyed the podcast, leave us a review, and we will see you next time.
Of Record is hosted and produced by me, Matt Farrar, Joe Clements, and Rebecca Romero, with producer Alex Reinhardt. Of Record is recorded at Graybridge Studios in Tallahassee, Florida. This episode was edited by producer Alex Reinhardt. Our theme music is composed and performed by Rob Goki. Special thanks to our entire team at SDS here in Tallahassee. You can see more information about the show at our website, podcastofrecord.com. As always, we'd appreciate your reviews and ratings in your podcast app of choice. Those ratings and reviews help more people discover the show, which helps us keep delivering quality content each week. Thanks for listening.